Citizens from around Minnesota are hooked up in the latest of our Newsnight, Minnesota Public Radio, Star Tribune, statewide forums. Our special thanks to the state's county extension agents for helping put together tonight's program. Our focus is rural communities. We'd like to welcome our guest tonight. First, Minnesota's Republican Senator Rod Grams joins us. As well, Senator Paul Wellstone from the other side of the aisle there in the Senate, and Governor Ventura, he was invited to this event, but he declined to participate. However, we do have two members of his administration. We have Gene Hugeson, who's Minnesota's Agriculture Commissioner, and Dean Barkley, who's the State Planning Director.
Our citizen participation comes from several sources, including the Star Tribune's booth at the State Fair. We're also joined by groups from around the state by video conference technology.
One group is taking part at the Nobles County Extension Agency in Worthington. We're also joined by citizens from Crookston in northwestern Minnesota. But we'll begin tonight right here in the KTCA studios in St. Paul. Lori Sturtevant from the Star Tribune is with a group of about 60 citizens. Lori, you have our first question for us.
Yes, I surely do. Dan Perkins is with me. He's a farm business management instructor at the Minnesota State College System based in Wilmer and in Morris. Dan knows a lot, I think, about what's happening in his part of the state. Can you fill us in, Dan?
Well, we talked earlier maybe just how to maybe look at the overall situation, and I guess I was just going to use an example in Morris where I work with about 60 producers and the farm business management. And as I look at it, the average age of the producer I work with is 46 years old, 31 at the low side, and up to 62 years of age. And I think they're the vital economic flow of that dollar that starts in the rural area. And as we look at this, I think we're talking about everybody wants to say the word rural crisis, but more maybe a rural dilemma, because it's widespread in terms of not just affecting the producers. But as I assess what's happened over the years, and not even because of the Freedom to Farm Bill, but just the situation we were in, is the financial reserves of most of these people in that age group, and with the volatility that's taken place, their financial reserves just weren't deep enough to deal with this volatility. And a lot of that's just because they were growing families, just the capital growth that was taking place in their operations. But the events that have taken place now, that these producers, and I consider them some of the best managers, that we have left throughout the state out there that are producing, can't afford any mistakes or any adverse situations. If they have a problem, it takes the recovery 5 to 8 years, and I think we can even go back to 93 and see a lot of producers were still recovering from that. I guess the key thing I want to bring up is, because of this type of producers, the tools out there really aren't adequate enough to deal with the type of producers that we have there. We really don't have a lot of deep financial reserves, and those that do seem to be able to weather this much better. And I guess that's the overall situation as I assess it today, and then we get these economic hotspots that take place.
So a question then would be, Dan, how can the federal government and the state respond to that situation?
Basically, looking at the situation and the type of people that are going to be bringing and be our new growth for the future, is how do we help these people that don't have those financial reserves deal with the volatility that we do have out there?
Should we start on the federal level, our senators? There's aid packages going on right now approved by the Senate. Graham?
Well, we've got a $7.4 billion package that was approved just before we left, but that's talking about short-term help, mm-hmm. and that's to help, hopefully help a lot of these farmers and producers to be able to be in the fields again next spring. And a lot of them are facing some real difficulties in whether they can make it or not, getting loans and everything from their banks to do that. But also, if we can get that passed, in which we will, I believe, when we go back, I think there's support for it. There'll be a conference in September. Those numbers could be adjusted up or down, I believe, is how the crops come in, what the prices are, et cetera. But we also got to look at, and I think you mentioned, for the long term. And I always kind of figured that Freedom to Farm was maybe 60 or 70% of the package, and some of the risk management tools that the farmers need, such as crop insurance reform, are very important. Trade agreements, long-term projections on the PL-480s, how do we help trade enhancement, or Export Administration Act is also up for reauthorization, and that is to open markets to give our farmers access to be able to compete in these markets. So there's a lot of things that we can do. The one thing we can't do, and that's that magic wand to raise over the crops and raise the prices. And I think we've got to find out what we can do and what we can't do.
Well, Dan, I can't see you behind the, but I know you're there, right? Always helps to see a person. I think your question is a very important question for Minnesota, not just for greater Minnesota, not just for farmers. Because, by the way, between 1996 and 1999, and you know this from your own work, we're going to see a drop of about $1.2 billion. That's the Farm Service Administration figure. That can multiply five times over in a community. Just imagine what that means for Minnesota for the future. The worst thing with the Freedom to Farm, Freedom to Fail bill is that what it basically did was it took away a safety net. Even the Washington Post now is editorializing that that was a mistake. The Star Tribune editorialized that that may have been a mistake. So what happens is when you have this severe downturn, only those farmers, those large farmers, in all too often cases conglomerates that have huge amounts of capital, can weather this storm. It is a price crisis. I am in complete disagreement with Senator Grahams. We can do something about price. We should take the cap off the loan rate, and we should get the price up. That is one of the most important things that we can do, and we don't have a whole lot of time to do it. And really, there's going to have to be a correction made, a modification made, or new legislation passed in order to get that price up. We absolutely ought to do that, and the sooner the better.
Mary, can I just answer a little bit?
I mean, we can talk about raising the price, but we can distort the markets in doing it. Do we need to open Freedom to Farm to look at some ways? Yes, we can. Maybe the loan rate. You know, it's either been $1.70 or $2.40. Maybe there's something in between that we can work on. But the one thing we don't want to do is price our commodities out of the world market and have these huge surpluses begin to back up even more. So we can raise the price, but it would be very short-term help and long-term disaster. So we've got to move some of this grain. We do have to try to get farmers that decent price in the field or something they can make a profit on. But we've got to be careful that we don't create a program today that's going to be a long-term disaster for our farmers at the same time.
I would beg to disagree. We have to decide whether we want to have a family farm structure of agriculture. Even the governor talked about the importance of self-reliance. In all due respect, $1.40 a bushel of corn doesn't have anything to do with self-reliance. You need to understand what's going on in agriculture. Family farmers need some leverage in the marketplace so they can get a decent price. That's what bumping the loan rate is all about. That's what the farmer-owned reserve was all about. That's what set-aside is all about. And we have to target it, and we have to focus it on family farmers. And if we don't do that, we will, within the next year and a half, lose it. What are you going to say to the 8 or 10,000 family farmers that are going to be gone this year? What is your answer for them? What is your answer for them right now? Because they're going to go under right now. And of course we can do something about the price. And that's what this is about. Family farmers in Minnesota and around the country want to be able to earn a decent living so they can support their families. And that's what a fair price is all about.
Senators, just for the interest of the layman watching who may not be in agriculture, when you're talking about bumping the loan rate, yes or no here, what exactly are you, you're not talking about a guaranteed floor for prices. What are you talking about?
You can do
there?
It a couple of different ways. What I'm simply saying, when I hear about the market, I smile. Family farmers, they've got a couple of grain companies that they sell to. And when they look at who they buy from, you have the same concentration of power. What the loan rate essentially says to farmers, you can do it a couple different ways, but what it essentially says for your corn or for your wheat or whatever is it says, look, we, the federal government, will say, we will, if you don't want to ship to Cargill, you want to hold on to your crop, we will guarantee a price, we will make a loan at this level. So let's say it's for corn, you got up to $2.20 or $2.30. I say to the extension agents, family farmers right now would go nuts if that was the case. That would be a huge improvement. And then basically the way it works, Martin, which makes all the sense in the world, is you say to the Cargills and other companies, look, either the farmers hold on to that or you buy it. You buy it at that level. That's the way it's always worked in the past until Freedom to Fail, in which case the farmers now sell to the grain companies, pay the federal government back, doesn't cost anything, but they need some way of having some leverage so they can get a decent price in the marketplace. And the farmers that are here know that. Now, trade policy we'll discuss later on.
Trade policy.
Senator Grahams, are you saying then no price supports, no help up?
No, in fact, right now I think on corn it's about $1.78 on the loan rate. And we're saying that it's either $1.78 or some have pegged it at $2.40, but nothing in between. What we're saying, and I agree with the senator, I think maybe there is some room there for adjustment. Maybe we couldn't bring it up, but I don't think we want to bring it up to 100% like soybeans. I mean, there always is some risk in the marketplace, but maybe 80 or 85% of maybe, you know, the price. And we can agree on some of those things. And we're going to talk about tax issues as well as trade issues. But everything isn't going to be solved just by the loan rate. There's a lot of complications out there and many different programs to look at. And it involves trade, it involves taxes, and it involves prices. So we need to look at all of this.
But it's great because we actually are working for some agreement, and I'm so pleased to hear that there's going to be some effort to change this policy because we can't stay with the present course. We cannot stay with the present course.
But we can't go back to the past.
Okay, let's move on to our next topic. We have some citizens ready in Crookston for the next question. Crookston, go ahead.
Yes, Howard Pearson. I'm the extension educator in Pennington County. And Wally Sparby, our aide to Senator, Representative Colin Peterson, is he was going to kind of sit back and listen, but we've put him in charge of our ag policy group, so I'm going to turn it over to Wally.
Thank you. I'm Wally Sparby from Thief River Falls, and this is the consensus of this group here this evening and the ag policy perspective here. First of all, we want to say thanks to the panel for the opportunity to present this information to you. We think that there's an overproduction out there in the agricultural sector, and we need a reduction in production and a form of supply management. It's kind of like the John Deere Company. They don't produce a whole lot more tractors than what they can sell, and I think we have to look at that in our grain policy as well, to make sure that we have a sale for it before we get into the production end of it. So we'd like to see a limited set-aside that's environmentally sound, and that's something that we think could be done and put into place by the Congress. The other thing is this group here decided that they would like to see a consumer reserve stored on the farm, where the payments would go to the farmers for that storage that would be commensurate and equal with the payments that are paid to the commercial institutions. And the fourth item that we talked about was an increase in the loan rates to the cost of production and an extension of those loans to 18 months instead of the period of time that they have in place today. And the fifth item that we talked about was the FCIC reform, federal crop insurance reform. We'd like to see something done on that, and I know the Senator Grams has worked on that, and we'd like to see something become of that, because certainly we have a high cost of the coverage that we get up here in this part of the state, and we'd like to see that reduced. And the other thing that we'd like to see is some fair trade policies for agriculture. We think that we've got a dilemma there that has to be dealt with, and we would hope that you folks in the Congress would be able to do that.
You want us to give yes or no's? Kind of like how? That's
quickly, yeah. that was a heck of a lot.
Wally, I'd like to thank you and all the other farmers and other people that were at Thief River Falls. I think it's an excellent set of suggestions, and I think, and I'm in complete agreement, and maybe the rest of us can talk about whether we're in agreement or not agreement, because we all should be held accountable. The only place where I would disagree is I wouldn't even have 18 months. You know what, when we're talking about the extension of the loan, I don't think that the grain companies actually should know. I mean, frankly, I want to see farmers, I want to give more power back to the producers. I'm just sick and tired of seeing our producers not getting a fair shake, but the rest of it I like. And on trade policy, the only thing I want to emphasize, now I'm looking at the right camera, the only thing I would emphasize is I think we're going to have to do what you talk about by way of set-aside. We're going to have to do it at an international level. I think it's come to the point where, rather than trying to have a trade policy based upon cheap grain, in which case our farmers go under anyway, that's what's the problem with just talking about exports, we're going to have to essentially talk, in Seattle, when we bring people together, and I know Colin will be there, we got to talk about how the exporting countries bring together the producers and agree to certain limits and put the emphasis on conservation and put the emphasis on environmental standards and bring some of the people from the metro areas in as allies. I think that's got to be an important part of our international agreement.
Let's bring some people from the state here. Several things mentioned there. Commissioner Hugeson.
Well, most definitely. And I think some of the things that Wally's talking about certainly need to be explored. I don't know that there's anything magic about a 9-month marketing loan, and certainly something beyond that. Senator probably makes some sense there when he's talking about the fact that anytime you have any kind of a definite line, end line, I'm not so sure if you went from 9 months to 15 months, you'd solve anything other than just, again, having a drop dead date there in which right. You have all the grain backing up. So maybe no end on it would make more sense in that respect. I think we have a problem, though, with the idea of looking at trying to get other countries to, in fact, look at controlling production, as much as that would be nice if that could happen. What's going to make sure that some of these other countries that really depend almost entirely for their national economy on ag exports, to get them to throttle back, knowing that that's going to keep them from expanding their local economy. So I just don't see as being feasible. But I think when you're looking at some opportunities for some short-term conservation programs that, such as the CRP for a 3 to 5 year period would offer some flexibility in some of those areas. Tie it into some opportunities to grow some trees or get some trees started on some of these areas that could serve some purposes other than necessarily just taking some land off the market, but also provide some opportunities for the farmers when that period is over. So there's some things out there that can be done.
Commissioner Higgins.
You know, when we were up in Rosso at the Farm Cabinet, first time I found out about it, I didn't grow up in a farm. I grew up in rural Minnesota, but not on a farm. When they told us that one of the avenues that the farmers were told to do was to go out and do crop specialization, where they go on contract with a specific producer to get a better price, then lo and behold, we find out that they can't get crop insurance because it's a specialized product. Now, that's some of the things I hope we're going to get a quick fix, that part of the solution, long-run solution for the farmer, and be able to diversify and get those contracts with a special, whether it's a grass seed up in northwestern Minnesota, whatever it's going to be, we have to be able to then have the same benefits as if they didn't do it or they're not going to do it. So hopefully that's something that it wouldn't take long to do. You get back that we can take a look of how we do crop insurance and allow these farmers to diversify and to get a better price for the product.
Yeah, absolutely. I think everyone would agree that something needs to be done on crop insurance from both the federal and the state levels as well. I was in Georgia over the weekend. The governor sent me down there because a number of my counterparts were working on some proposals as it relates to crop insurance, and we're looking at something in terms of covering cost of production, recognizing that it's going to be different parts of the country for different crops and trying to come up with something that would work there. So we're from the State Departments of Agriculture sector, we're putting some things together which we're going to be sharing with Congress here in the next few months as well. So there's a type of things that we need to be working on together in an effort to solve some of this.
There were two of the points that people from Thief River Falls made. They put a strong emphasis on taking the cap off the loan rate and getting the price up to cost of production. Do you, as a goal, do you agree with that?
Well, I'm not.
I'd be interested in how people respond, because the price is key.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything magic about the loan rates at where they are right now.
Okay.
There's room for some fluctuation, but on the other hand, I think if you go too high, we run the risk of creating incentives for other countries to do some things that, in fact, is going to make things worse. I was reading someplace recently where it says that any time the federal government in the United States does something that's affecting prices in the United States, generally it's our competitors that benefit from it first rather than even the people in this country. So we got to be careful what we do doesn't create some problems someplace else.
But you see the need to fix what we've got now and make some changes here.
Well, certainly we've got to make some changes, but I think to go back to what we had before isn't going to solve the problems either. We had a lot of people that went out of business under the old farm bill too, so I don't see that as the solution either.
Commissioner, just briefly, on a point of sort of global vision here, does the administration buy into it all, Senator Wellstone's understanding of this sort of too much power being concentrated in the hands of the companies, this view that perhaps a lot of this crisis is a matter of Cargill the Ventura administration. Mm-hmm. Do you have a problem with that, or do you agree with that sense that there's a power imbalance in the world of agriculture right now between corporations and farmers?
I think the general feeling is that we're not happy with what's going on in that situation. On the other hand, what is the magic number in terms of the size of an operation to be? A lot of these companies, for whatever reason, have gotten themselves into some real financial binds as it relates to some of the things they've done. And so you've got a case where one company takes over another company that oftentimes is for their own. Somebody is in financial trouble and they have no choice. If they go out of business and we've got the power of the powerful survive, the others don't. We don't like it. And certainly the administration needs to be enforcing antitrust kind of laws and making sure that things aren't being done. But I think it's wrong to say that that's the what's causing all the problems out there. We've got farms that are getting larger for some of the same reasons as well.
Antitrust is a federal issue, but Director Barkley, these mega mergers, we had right in our backyard, Cargill and Continental Grain earlier. Does this concern the administration?
Well, I think you have to have your head in the sand not to be concerned if this is a trend that's going to continue. I call it the Walmarting of ag. It's happened in other sectors.
the franchising, the larger has gotten larger, the bigger have gotten bigger. Main Street, rural Minnesota, they know what happens when Walmart and Target and Cub Food comes into the regional center. If you live within 30 miles of that regional center and you've got a retail store, you're going to go out of business unless you really scramble. And I think you're seeing some of those same forces at work in agriculture. And if there was an easy answer, we could give it to you. But you couldn't stop it. Our own family business in Annandale went out of business after 50 years because of those same pressures. We didn't adapt quick enough to the larger competitor. And I really don't know how you stop it.
Well, you could, Dean, you could, at the state level, I mean, I think it's, I don't know how you stop it at the state level, although Attorney General Hatch may have some ideas, but I think just being outspoken about it, the way I always taught about it and learned about it was that when you have four firms that dominate over 50% of the market, you have a problem. You don't have the competition that you want. Farmers want more of competition. But at the federal level, you could have you could have stiff financial penalties for violation of the laws. You could have within the Justice Department a separate division that deals with problem of conglomerates in agriculture. Food is a very precious part of our economy. It's so important. You could also have a very careful analysis of all mergers and acquisitions with their effect, not just on consumers, but producers. You could do a lot of things that would make a difference. This is just one piece, but we need to really take a close look at
this. We need to hear from some more citizens.
That was done during this last merger, though. A lot of those things the Senator talked about were done.
They're starting to do more. I don't agree with what Justice Department all that it ended up saying, but there's Joe Klein's doing more.
But the largest two co-ops also have merging. That's we don't right. hear much about that.
Sure.
Somehow, and they'll control nearly 50% of the farmers.
Sure.
So where is the opposition to that? And we haven't heard a lot about that.
Okay, well, let's hear from more of our citizens. We're ready in Worthington. Question from Worthington. Go ahead.
Yes, my name is Tim Henning. I'm a farmer south of Lismore, Minnesota. Federal crop insurance is not our biggest problem. That shouldn't even be on the list. It should be more down on the bottom. We've got to get a hold of some supply management. We cannot plant fence row to fence row. It didn't work in the Earl Butts era, and it's not working today. The Chicago Board of Trade sets the world price. Every other country in the world goes off our prices. They trade in the overnight markets. We've got to get back to supply management. And we got to, in our negotiations, we have got to move ag up on the list instead of down on the list and quit using agriculture as a pawn. Is this something that could be done, or are we just sitting out here in the wind waiting to wither up and die?
Too much freedom to farm?
No, I think we need to look at some supply management, but I think as Commissioner Huguenin said, you know, it's hard to get all the countries to do that, because if we would set aside an acre, Brazil or Argentina would put another acre into production, then we would lose competition, we would lose our markets. Is it a goal? Yes. Should it be in the trade talks? We should look at it. But to say that we're going to get all the other countries to agree on something that we can't even agree on in this country is going to be very hard to do. But I think it can be a goal, and that's something that's been talked about. So,
well, the set-aside was done away with in the Freedom to Fail bill. And it was predictable what was going to happen. We were supposed to do great in exports, but now we have decent weather around the world, and we've got a surplus. I think in our own country, it can be part of our policy, along with what you're talking about, Tim, which is dealing with the price crisis and getting the price up. If someone wants to farm the whole county, bless their heart. But we don't need to be concerned about a lot of their acres or bushels of production. We should target this on our mid-sized family farmers. We've talked about antitrust action. Again, I would say with trade policy, and Commissioner Huguenin made a good point about other countries, but I think what's happening right now is a lot of other governments are having to do the same thing we're doing, which farmers don't really want, which are these credit bailouts year after year. They want to be able to get the price. They're now doing it in a lot of other countries as well because of this cheap grain policy, which helps the exporters, but it doesn't help the producers. So I think in our trade agreement, we give power back to the producers. We have some agreement on a threshold you don't go above in terms of production, and Dean Barkley, you put a strong emphasis not just on the Conservation Reserve Program, which is good, but also you give credit and provide economic incentives for farmers who follow good land stewardship practices. We need to do much more of that as well. I think that's our future, but we got to fight for it, and we got to make it. The reason I'm so serious tonight is we don't have a lot of time left. A lot of producers are going to be gone if we don't make some changes soon.
If I make the point, you know, I've been in business most of my life, And he makes the point, until the farmer, until the supply part of their equation, they get a handle on it. Look what happened with the oil cartel. If you're going out paying $1.26 now a gallon for gas, that's because the producers managed to get together, cut production, and the price went up. Unfortunately, that's not a model that the U.S. farmer has been able to emulate. And barring them being able to do that, they have some, they have to be, you know, heroic. They're the biggest gamblers, I think, of any business person, because they have no control over their end price. And anyone knows in business that if you continue not to be able to meet your cost of production year after year, you cannot stay in business. And that's what we have to get a grip with. These farmers are sitting out there producing better than any other farmers in the world, but can't get their cost of production. And that's what we're up into right now. Northwestern Minnesota sooner than the rest of the state because they've had weather problems on top of it. But that's the dilemma that I think this country has to face for a farm policy of how do you get a handle on that cost and what you get return on it.
With the Ventura message of self-sufficiency, that seems to be not price support, self-sufficiency, how do you get a handle on that?
Well, part of what we're doing, and Gene's part of this, we are taking a look at what the state can do. I mean, international trade policy, we cannot sit there and do anything in St. Paul with other than work with our congressional delegation. And as the governor went with the milk pricing, he went there and brought that to the forefront. But what we can do is try to help rural Minnesota diversify their economy for long term. The first thing you let off here was the computer telecommunications. We have to make sure that the private sector goes out and connects all of rural Minnesota, and if they don't, we have to go in there and fill in the gaps so businesses can move. All your new high-paying businesses are going to be, most of them, linked to telecommunications. And if rural Minnesota doesn't have that infrastructure, they are not going to develop it. So maybe, I remember you gave the age of 46. Was the average farmer you work with. I've seen figures of age 55 is the average of the farmer right now, and that's a demographic reality of what's happening to the farm. It's because the young 20-year-old farmer who would like to stay on the farm or the 30-year-old can't stay in rural Minnesota because they don't have the job opportunities, or they could go and get a good part-time job and help dad and eventually take the farm over. That's part of the long-range thing that we can do as a state of get businesses located out in rural Minnesota, give them the infrastructure, because that's where the workers are that aren't in the Twin Cities. And that's what we're working on right now with the state policy.
But there's two.
Commissioner?
Okay. Yeah, I think, you know, when you're talking about from the administration standpoint in terms of the self-sufficiency or what we're doing, part of the idea is to do what we can to help farmers to have some other alternatives other than just the corn and the soybeans. Are there some other crops we can help people move in or some other opportunities in terms of taking some of that pressure off just those commodities that where these problems are? The other thing is that while in essence the foreign trade issues are something that we can't control from the state level, yet there are things that we can do in terms of like the governor's going to Japan in November, and part of the idea is that there are some unique opportunities for some specific products to go from Minnesota to a specific market, which in this case Japan, having some of the best opportunities for some long-term chances in the Asian economy.
And on the governor's itinerary, speaking of Japan, it says a special event showcasing Minnesota agriculture. What will that be?
Well, actually what we're looking at is that we'll have a two-hour cooking demonstration that will be using Minnesota products that the governor will be helping to prepare with the chef that will be there using Minnesota meats, Minnesota's vegetables, and knowing that there's a lot of interest in Japan for the governor already, has some opportunities to highlight what we're doing.
I have to jump in here. First of all, I think that both what's being said by Dean and Gene makes sense in terms of economic development and self-sufficiency, and we can talk more about it. And I think the EPA ruling on MTBE is great for ethanol, and we can do more on value added, and we can do more on new uses of products. But for family farmers to hear this lecture about self-sufficiency, in all due respect, is almost insulting. $1.40 a bushel of corn or $2.70 a bushel of wheat or $4 beans doesn't have anything to do with farmers and whether they're self-sufficient. You have to understand what's going on in agriculture. And it's great to go to Japan. Let's do it. But you want to know something? Again, time is not neutral. And we're going to lose a whole generation of producers. And it is a price crisis. And you can't preach self-sufficiency because we've been talking about the structure of agriculture. It's very important the governor understand that. He needs to understand it well.
Senator Wellstone, we want to get to some of the crowd here in our St. Paul studios. Lori Sturtevant standing by with another question.
I have Dave Richter, a farmer from Montgomery, a pork and crop producer, and he's been wanting to get a word in edgewise here for a while.
Hello. I think I know where Senator Wellstone stands on this issue, so I'm going to direct this one to Senator Grahams. First off, it's a main concern of ours for our future as far as defining the difference between a family farm versus industrialized agriculture. There's only so much we can do with these margins out there. Cost of living keeps going up. We can do very little with the margins we have, so we are going to be forced to expand. Every other industry out there has to do this. We're seeing the huge conglomerates coming together because they can't make it on their own. I don't see how we can get away from this. And regulation targeted to too small of operations is going to put the producers out of business because we're looking at the producers that their sole income is from agriculture, and that's their business. They don't have some of them don't have off-farm jobs. So if Senator Grahams could define what he feels in our future the difference between family farm and industrialized ag would be.
Well, somebody once told me the word family farm has almost become obsolete because now it's farming families, because you're involved maybe with brothers or family operations or other type of when you look at agriculture in the United States over the last 300 years, we've gone through tremendous evolution. It used to be about 90% of our population was involved in agriculture. Now we have 2% that are producers. And when you say scale of economy, and that's what we're looking at, how big do you have to get? And we want to have something in the farm bill that doesn't say you have to be large in order to be successful. But where do we go? I mean, how do you define it? What government regulations are you going to put on the size and the scope of family farms or farming family operations? Price reporting, I mean, that's something we've talked about. But is each state going to have their own price reporting system? Or how are you going to do with market concentration? Are you talking about contracting out? Or do we want to have market competition, which I think is healthy? So in the long run, I don't know how we're going to define it or how you're going to control, or are you going to put a definition on what is continuing to be an evolution in farming?
Senator, do you believe there's inherent value to smaller farms to this country in the long term? And if so, how much should we spend as a society to keep them small?
Well, I mean, are we going to distort the markets, and are you going to prop up? And I would say that people should have the opportunity, if they want to have a small farm operation, 240, you've heard of sustainable agriculture, but our farm bills are always skewed toward, scales of largeness. But can you be profitable in sustainable agriculture? There are a lot of them that say you can, and there's some that are doing it. But I hate to set farm policies that's going to dictate your operation or tell you what you're going to plant, how you're going to plant it. And I think that should be left up to you, your decision, what's best for your operation. And our things that we need to do, and Senator Wellstone is talking about, setting loan rates. Maybe there's room to do that to make sure that there are the margins there for people to be successful. But you're going to have to make the decisions on what you want to do and how you're going to do it rather than the government setting up for you.
I'm not allowed to answer the question, right? I'm going to go with you. I'm going to defer to you. Unless you let me try.
What I don't want to see is regulations. Yeah. Limit the success
yeah.
of our operations.
Yeah, what I was going to say, because and we can debate this if you want, but I'm not so sure we will. I think the definition of a family farm has everything to do with the pattern of entrepreneurship. It means that the people who work the land live on the land. That's what I'm interested in. And frankly, what I fear is that, since you're a pork producer, what I fear is at the moment, many of our pork producers face extinction, but the packers are in hog heaven. IBP made record profits. The farm retail spread grows wider and wider. So I don't want this to become vertically integrated where you lose your power of decision making. And I don't think you disagree with me on that.
Right. And part of that is covered in corporate farm law right now. That, the majority of interest has to be the majority of interest of the owned operation has to be a producer.
In Minnesota.
Yes, in Minnesota. In Minnesota.
But if you want to look at farm regulations and government programs, look at the dairy program and tell me that farmers in Minnesota like that type of regulation or control. And what we have is a federal government with an antiquated dairy program that steps on the necks of our producers while rewarding others around the country. And we need to get rid of that, and I've introduced bills to do that as well. But that's where over-regulation or control from Washington can spell disaster for some of our farmers.
Okay, let's move on to the Great Minnesota Get Together. We do have another audience out there at the State Fair. Go ahead, State Fair.
Hi, I'm Mary Stearns. I'm from Eagan. And I just wanted to go back to something that was stated earlier. How can urban Minnesota help support rural Minnesota? And I guess one of the ways that I see we can do that is by help supporting or keeping informed of what's going on out there and stay informed citizens, and also write to our legislators. And besides that, I just also think that we need to support our local farmers and buy Minnesota-grown products and organic products or anything Minnesota-grown. And how can you suggest we can help in other ways?
Well, I think you know the lady makes a very, very good point, and there is a Minnesota Growing program that's in existence right now, in which some foods are identified in grocery stores, at farmers markets, and so forth, as being grown in the state. One of the other things that we're doing that is geared towards trying to help solve some of this problem of the farmers not getting some of that middle part of that whole price chain is doing some specialty types of direct marketing from Minnesota farms right to either consumers themselves, to the grocery stores, to restaurants, through what's called the State Meat Inspection Program. We're going to be seeing more of that sort of thing happening, and the Department of Agriculture puts out a brochure that tells people how they, in fact, can deal directly with Minnesota producers that do some direct marketing. And if they want to call the Department of Agriculture, we'll be sure to get them that information.
The other part of that woman's message was informing people, letting people know in urban Minnesota, in greater Minnesota, what's going on. What can the state's role be there, Dean Barclay?
Well, I think that's exactly it. I think people living in the metropolitan area, people living in Plymouth and the suburbs, they have to realize that what happens out in rural Minnesota is going to impact what happens in the metropolitan area. This area is going to grow by about 600,000 more people in the next 20 years, approximately 20 years. We already have urban sprawl issues. Our agency has to get a look at, we have an urban GEIS that we have to undertake to try to get a handle on growth. And if we don't get our rural communities healthy places with the same advantages, the same infrastructure, the same diverse background to keep the 20-year-old out in rural Minnesota, to let the St. Clouds, the Mankatos, the Wilmers, the Alexandrias, the other areas that grow and be healthy, or else we're going to have 800,000 more people here in the next 20 years, and it's going to be even more untenable here. So we have to let people know here in Minnesota, when we're talking about helping rural Minnesota, it's not us versus them.
But how do you make people care about it here in the metro area?
Well, by going on KTCA for an hour and a half and letting them air their differences and going out and speaking and letting them know that. I mean, we've got several things that we're doing in our agency, from the workforce team that we're working on and the worker shortage that we have, to go out and let them know that we're in this together, that what happens out there is critically important to what happens here. We're not isolated islands.
Barry? I grew up on a dairy farm. I know what it is out there, and I've got family still on the farm. I still own the farm that I grew up on. You know, getting up at 4:30 for milkings and, you know, working all day and et cetera. But when you talk about being able to keep our young people out on the farms, there's less and less opportunities for them, and one of them is the ability to stay on the farm, and that is for the parent to be able to transfer that farm to the young person, his son or whatever it might be. And we need changes in our tax laws. Get rid of this estate tax. Get rid of that. Get rid of the capital gains, and in some respects, but give our young farmers the opportunity to find the way to stay on the farm. I talk to a lot of farmers out there, and I hear this over and over. The last thing I'd want to do is sentence my son to a future in farming. For one thing, they can't afford to get into farming. So we need to do some things as well to keep young people on the farms, and that's to give them the opportunities. And one big barrier is the estate tax and capital gains tax that keeps them off.
Senator, I've talked to quite a few Republican candidates for a variety of offices about the ag problem. They often cite the estate tax, the inheritance tax, sometimes called the death tax, as one of the main problems. Why isn't that being passed by Congress?
Well, it's part of our package in the $792 billion tax break plan, or the tax relief plan that we have now, that's going to go to the president's desk next week. And he can make a decision on whether giving tax relief, including estate tax relief, or he can veto it. And I hope he takes a real strong look at it and supports this bill.
Is that a priority?
We're skirting all around here. Let me go back to urban. I think the question was about urban America. Mary asked, you know, how can we get people in the metropolitan area more interested? Be pleased to deal with the other part later. I think that, and I tell you, for those people that heard your question that are living in greater Minnesota, just your question alone, I think, gives people some faith. Thanks for the question. I think the religious community, I look sometime to this, sometime between Thanksgiving and Hanukkah, Christmas, as a time after farmers' harvest is over, where I think the religious community can really be important in bringing a lot of farmers and rural citizens to the metro area. With a lot of coverage of what's said and a lot of dialogue and discussion. We are in this together, and I could go through the economics, but just to say that, okay. I think it's terribly important to do for two reasons. One, so that metropolitan, let me just finish this real quickly, so that metropolitan Minnesota, for that matter, metropolitan America, knows what's at stake for them and their families, and a lot is in terms of price of food, in terms of the environment, in terms of quality of food. But the other reason, there's so much pain out there. I mean, I expect to see, without being melodramatic, suicides, and I don't want to see them. There's so much pain. I mean, when I am at any gathering, someone will come up and say, thanks for caring, and I'll look to shake their hand. This may have happened to all you, and they're crying. So just also for people to know in greater Minnesota that their support means a lot, and we need to do that.
Let's hear from greater Minnesota. Let's go to Crookston, our citizens there.
This is Richard Nelson. I'm Director of Agriculture and Natural Resources here at the University of Minnesota Crookston. We're fortunate to have visits by both senators in the last week or so, and we appreciate that, and glad to see you here again tonight. In my position in agriculture, I think you can imagine that I'm very supportive and anxious to do as much as we can for farmers that are in need right now. However, I think it's important to remember that long before the current farm bill, rural communities were suffering population declines. Long before the farm bill, we were seeing rapidly rising average age of farmers. People are making other choices about what to do with their lives and careers. So for that reason, I'd like to focus in on the idea of economic diversity and new ventures, and the idea of separating rural policy from farm policy. Dean Barclay mentioned earlier about the commitment, I think it was a commitment, by the administration to see that all of rural Minnesota was connected with communications and information technology satisfactory to support today's businesses. In addition to technology, which admittedly is a critical factor, what other sorts of things are we looking at in policy issues, not only at the state level, but at the federal level, again, apart from farm policy, but in the context of rural policy, recognizing that farming no longer is the only industry out here. Fixing the family farm crisis is very important, but it will not probably fix the rural economic situation that we're in, even in small towns like ours, where most of the children in schools, in fact, are not farm kids.
Yeah, I can give you a specific example that came out of our workforce task force, where we've identified the number one impediment for economic growth in Minnesota is a worker shortage. So Jerry Carlson of DTED has initiated a brand new program where he is contacting all the high-growing businesses in the metropolitan area right now that, quite frankly, cannot find workers to supply the demand that they have. And he is contacting them to try to start marrying these companies that want to expand, that need new workers, into greater Minnesota. It's just started in the last couple of months. He's got two full-time people working on it now. He's doing a complete screening of all these businesses, what new satellites they want to operate, how many employees, and they're trying to match up this need to greater Minnesota so we can start putting more business development in Crookston, in greater Minnesota, to start providing those better paying jobs that'll pay $18, $20, $22 an hour rather than $8, $9, or $10 that can support a young family. So that's just one example of where we're trying to diversify rural Minnesota.
Just one other thing to add from that. At the governor's direction, the commissioners that are part of the farm cabinet have been instructed to look at the whole competition issue for Minnesota as it relates to where do our businesses, whether they're ag or non-ag, face some competition with other market types of operations. It used to be that workers' comp was the big issue that caused problems for rural Minnesota with neighboring states. So what we're instructed to do is be looking at a number of other issues that might exist out there in order to make sure that those businesses in rural Minnesota, including farms, are in a position to compete with what's going on elsewhere.
Okay, let's go to Lori Sturvin with another question from the audience.
Yes, I have with me Duke Husty, the fellow with one foot in the suburbs in Long Lake and one in rural Minnesota with a farm down in Lanesboro.
Yeah, a couple things have come. Sometimes with this rural development, you end up with conflicts. In other words, what's good for rural development oftentimes is somewhat anti-agriculture. You know, the scenery sells. You know, the land values in the western states, the scenic states, have gone through the ceiling. The land values in the Great Plains states haven't moved since 1980. So if you want to get people to move to rural Minnesota, you're going to have to be careful about odors. You're going to have to be careful about manure spills. You're going to have clean streams and clean lakes. And oftentimes, these kind of regulations conflict with the farmer's desire to farm as cleanly or quickly as efficiently as he would like. And you want to touch a base on that and talk about how a greener, cleaner Minnesota conflicts with some of the current agricultural practices?
Well, you know, what you raise there is part of a real problem that exists out there for anybody that particularly is within commuting distance of the Twin Cities, because we've got farmers that are trying to make a living on land that agriculturally should be worth about $600 an acre. And yet what's happening is because of commuters moving into the area, that land now is up to $900, $1,000 or even more. And so that creates some real conflicts. And at the same time, the people that are moving into that area have different values in terms of what they want. They want it quiet after 10 o'clock at night. They don't want anybody working in their fields all night. They don't want animal smells other than their horses that they might bring with them, kind of thing. And so part of the intolerance that's developing from there is becoming a real problem. And that's part of the reason why this administration has made that a priority issue to be looking at, because those are real problems that are existing out there, and frankly will probably only get worse. Now, is there an easy solution to them? No. And that's going to be a real dilemma. But I think people need to understand that when you, in fact, are moving into an area that is zoned agricultural, there needs to be some understanding that these people are trying to make a living. It's not a residential area. Now, does that mean we don't have a clean environment? Absolutely not, because that's something that is of value from everyone. But in terms of some of the other issues, it's a real dilemma.
Richard, I just want to make a couple of quick points. One on the metro area, I want to make it clear that there is this problem, as Gina said, about land values going up, but in a lot of parts of our state, I'm very worried about whether land values will stay where they're at. They could very well go down. I met with 35 bankers, and there's a lot of concern about where we're heading. Second of all, I would like to say that, again, going back to metro Minnesota, that I think when just a very few people own the land and you move to an industrialized, corporatized agriculture, you're going to see much less concern for the environment. And I believe that the environmental issues will be a part of the future of family farm structure of agriculture. It's one of the ways we can get the most support from other people, that and we need that support. And then my final point on economic development, I have to say this, is I think there are two questions young people ask when they think about whether they're going to stay in our communities in greater Minnesota. A, can I afford to? Can I make a decent price or find a job at a decent wage? And second of all, do I want to? And that has to do with whether there'll be good schools, whether there'll be good hospitals, whether there'll be a good environment, whether there'll be small businesses there. And Dean, I really like the idea of connecting up a lot of hardworking people who work with numbers. We're now telecommuting. We've got information technology companies that are growing. And I think there's ways of having that marriage. But that's no substitute for fighting for family farms.
Well, is there a point where this state needs to admit that there's going that ultimately to save the rural economy, we have to abandon some of our romantic ideas about independent farming, though?
Wait a minute.
I mean, if you're talking about getting people jobs in corporations in outstate Minnesota.
Well, Martin, this isn't, what's happening isn't Adam Smith's invisible hand. The only inevitability to what's happening right now is the inevitability of a stacked deck. Absolutely not. We will, if we move, if conglomerates muscle their way to the dinner table, someone will always own the land and someone will own the animals. It's a question of whether they'll be family farmers. We will regret this as a nation for many, many reasons. It's not just a romantic idea. It's very much in our national interest. In addition to that, we ought to be talking about, not as a substitute, but in addition to family farms, we ought to be talking about lots of strategies for economic development in greater Minnesota.
Minnesota has some very strict laws as it relates to corporate ownership. I mean, so there's some of the things that go on in some other states will not happen here unless the laws change. I don't see that happening. On the other hand, you know, there can be a, such a thing as too much independence in the sense that what I think I see farmers moving to more now is sort of an interdependence on each other. In other words, they're doing things together that they didn't necessarily do before. They own some machinery together because it costs too much to have it all yourself. They're exchanging some labor. They're going into some joint business ventures together, these kinds of things. So you're still going to need to see some changes take place. Will it mean the end of the family farm? No, not necessarily.
Sounds like corporate behavior without being a corporation.
Well, I wouldn't even call it corporate behavior. I mean,
in the sense of group behavior.
Yes, that's and what's wrong with that? I mean, that's co-ops. Minnesota has been doing that for over 100 years anyway, so it's just a different way of doing a cooperative type of effort, not necessarily with a lot of shareholders, but maybe just a small group.
Like Senator Wellstone said, the land is going to be farmed. It all depends on who farms it. And it's not only if it's corporate farmers compared to family farms, it's what's it going to do to the rural communities, the churches, the schools, healthcare, etc. And I had one person tell me that he, along his road, when he was a kid, there were 7 families and about 40 kids. Today, he is the only one left on that road, and he only has 3 children. So what does that do when you go into town? Is it the theater going to be there? Is the school going to be there, etc.? So it could be changing the face of rural America. And to what extent can we do, and can we artificially prop up to do this? And this is where all the farm policy, if it was easy, we would have had the answer.
Okay, I have to jump in right now. Some of our viewers are going to leave us now, but for many of you, we will have extended coverage going on right here for another half an hour. So for those of you leaving, thank you very much for joining us. If you're watching in Appleton, Bemidji, Austin, and in the Twin Cities, stay right there. You'll have more TV coming up. And Twin Cities viewers, listen to this. Take note, we'll be going on to Channel 17 at this point. That's KTCI Channel 17, so you can turn the dial over now. Also, Minnesota Public Radio stations will also air this extended coverage. So if you want more discussion, there's an option for you wherever you might be right now. So for some more, we'll have good night. Thank you so much for joining us. The rest of you will be right back in a couple minutes.